So last week, Jawaharlal Nehru introduced the concept of a mandala, and this was a way of introducing us to the theme for the next 4 weeks, which is exploring the Buddha mandala. So the image we have on the left-hand side of the shrine here, right-hand side of the shrine, is a representation of this Buddha mandala. So what this mandala is representing is the different qualities of the Buddha's wisdom, the Buddha's compassion. And one of the things that we are doing, reason that we're moving into this area, is really so that we can get a fuller sense of what the Buddha is, how we can come into a greater, a stronger relationship to it. So I'm just going to, the structure of my talk this evening is I'm just going to give two reasons for exploring this Buddha mandala, and then I'm going to be talking specifically about the first figure that we're looking at, which is the blue, dark blue figure of Akshobhya. And I'm just going to draw out a couple of aspects of the figure. So I'm going to be saying something about this object, this symbol, and I'm going to be saying something about his mudra of the earth touching mudra. So that's what I'm going to do tonight. So as I mentioned, there's two reasons possibly for engaging with the Buddha mandala. So the first one is that it really helps us to give shape and create conceptual pointers to what is actually beyond concepts. So the Buddha actually is utterly mysterious. The whole nature of enlightenment is beyond anything we can communicate through words. So all we can do is kind of point to it in various different ways, using symbols, colours, movement, sound, stories, etc. And all of these are trying to give us some indication of the territory that we as Buddhists are trying to move towards. We're trying to indicate the territory that this shrine, this whole rationale for this shrine being here, why that's here, and in a way why the whole Buddhist center is here. It's here because of the significance, the content, if you like, of this Buddha mandala. The Buddha mandala really is a vision of the goal, a transcendental goal. And I think it's really important to get hold of this aspect that actually Buddhism has something specific that we're trying to, through our practice, through our meditation, that we are actually trying to come into relationship to. Because what that being clear about this goal is that it helps us distinguish between the mundane goals that we might be pursuing in our life and the radical transformation that Buddhist practice is offering us. It might be quite likely that all of us, to some extent, we're here with the aim, with the goal perhaps of making ourselves happier, more peaceful, more content. And all these things are, on their own terms, very useful kind of things to be aspiring to move towards. So they're great aspirations, but they are not the goal of Buddhist practice. So these things are very seductive. Peacefulness, contentment, happiness, but they are byproducts of what happens as a result of engaging with the Dharma, engaging with Buddhist practice. The Dharma is offering us, challenging us, for something which is far more radical than perhaps most of us realise as we step through these doors. One of the central intentions behind Buddhist practice is to actually dismantle any attachment to a fantasy of bolstering an imagined separate self. It's this fantasy of a separate selfhood that is causing us to chase after happiness, continual happiness, continual peace, continual contentment. This questing after fleeting and pleasurable sensations has unfortunately ensnared all of us for countless lifetimes. And the goal of practice, of Buddhist practice, is to be able to support us to live wholeheartedly, knowing that everything we see, everything we believe, everything we love is actually impermanent, transitory, and ultimately insubstantial. So the aim of the Dharma is to describe the means and the processes through which we are liberated from all our views, all our biases, to help us so that we aren't swayed by these fleeting experiences of pain and pleasure. And the more we can kind of live in this flux of pain and pleasure without resisting it or trying to draw particular aspects of our experience towards us, then that gives rise to the possibility, at least, of the wisdom and compassion which is described in this Buddha Mandala. There's a possibility that can begin to manifest in our individual lives, not for just our own benefit, but for the benefit of all. So this is the first reason for exploring this mandala. And this might sound a bit abstract, a bit remote, idealistic even. So the second reason I'd like to posit for exploring the mandala is helping us to build a relationship with the goal through imagery, through our imagination, through symbols. Once we begin to engage our imagination, that then begins to trigger our emotional responses. Imagination encourages us or allows us to play with, reflect on, contemplate specific forms, symbols and images. And by playing in this way, by playing with imagery, playing with symbols, we're more likely to begin to feel them in us, know them directly, without this kind of filtering limitation of trying to approach the goal conceptually. So to help us do this, what we do is just allow more space around our responsiveness. Actually, to be with these symbols in a way, just give them time to kind of work into us. And be open to getting a feel of what is our emotional response to this collection of objects, to these symbols, to these ideas that we're discussing tonight. The other thing about the emotional life and imaginative engagement is not only it's not that we just move towards the imagery, the symbolism, the goal of practice, but there's something about imagination which actually allows the imagery to move towards us, to enter us. So it's actually becoming more receptive, basically, to symbolism through opening our emotional life, opening emotionally to this material. So what I'm going to do tonight is start with akshobhya. So akshobhya is, so all these figures, if you imagine them to be made of light. So we can imagine a being of light, and this particular light is a very dark blue. And the dark blue figure of akshobhya sits in the meditation posture. And his left hand is relaxed and open in here in his lap. And in the in this open hand there is this object here, the vajra. So that stands poised in the left hand of akshobhya. And in his right hand, the right hand is relaxed, just lying over his knee and just lightly touching the earth. So this is the mudra of akshobhya, the kind of symbolic gesture of this particular Buddha figure. And so what I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to talk about the vajra and then talk about that mudra. And end just by saying a little bit about the element of water. So these different aspects, there is a chart of all these different aspects of the different of the Buddhas, and I'll put these out on the table. If you want to take them away with you, then do that at the end of the evening. So this really lays out all the different symbols, images, mudras of each of the different characters we're going to be looking at over the next few weeks, 4 weeks. So, I'm going to start with looking at the vajra. This object, you've probably all seen it if you looked at any particularly Tibetan imagery. This object is very common. If you look at the figure behind Steve, for instance, you'll see this is held in the hand by Padmasambhava, and well, obviously it's here in the imagery of akshobhya. So what does this mean? What does this object mean in terms of its symbolism? So just to say, I think this is one of the most important and beautiful images, objects in Buddhism. I really, I find it a great source of solace, this object. So why is that? So I'll just speak you through it. So in the centre of the vajra, there is this, well, sometimes described as an egg or a circle, a sphere. And this sphere, although, because this is a three-dimensional object, we have to, well, it's kind of constrained by its three-dimensional nature. But actually, this sphere, although it sits at the centre, you also have to imagine it actually envelops the whole, simultaneously envelops the whole object. So this central portion is described as the non-dual state. So this is the state that is beyond or beneath all polarities. This sits at the heart of, or is the heart of reality. A non-dual state that is not split, that is not divided, in that it can hold all polarities. It can hold all dualities. So this central portion of the symbol, out of it erupts two lotus flowers. So you can see this kind of the two flowers arising out of the central sphere. And the two lotuses, these two blossomings, if you like, are the basis of all dualistic experience. So me and you, in and out, wisdom and ignorance, etc., etc. They all spring out of this same non-dual experience. So traditionally, from this basic splitting of experience, arise a whole flowering of different manifestations, different appearances. So out of these lotuses, we have what are called markaras, which are these dragon-like creatures, and these are the tongues of the the markaras, kind of growing out of this basic splitting of experience. So the markaras really describe or symbolise the different types of arising experience. And traditionally, we have the wisdoms at one end. So out of this basic polarity, we get the wisdom, the different wisdoms of the Buddhas. And at the other end, we get the different poisons of the deluded being. The poisons of greed, hatred, etc., pride, envy. So all these things kind of blossom at either end. So that's the beginning of the symbol. But I find what's really crucial about it and key is that if you look at it from this end, you'll see that there is running through all these kind of splitting of experience. There's an axis that runs right through the centre of all these experiences. And what that tells me, and what I find so fantastic, is that it doesn't matter where we find ourselves on the which tongue, which marker we're kind of manifesting in any moment, what experience we find ourselves within, whether it's a very sublime state or whether it's a very difficult negative mental state, there is always a route back to this central core. We are intimately connected at all times with this non-dual state. The only thing that separates us is our splitting of experience. The only thing that kind of takes us away is to become identified with this one small fragment of our experience. So it may be this kind of identification with a particular mental state, a particular physical sensation. But the more we become curious about that state, the more we really explore it and enter it, what we discover is that it just gradually dissipates and resolves itself back into this open, non-dual state. If we could really stay with experience and resist the temptation to fix it or grip it or resist it, if we really could do that wholeheartedly, fully, we would naturally be led back to this non-dual experience. So this is the wonder of this object. It's why these figures, or many figures, hold this amazing piece of, well, this truth that we cannot be split from the goal. The goal is right here with us. It's said that it's our practice, our kind of experience now isn't separate or cannot be separated from reality itself. If we really just settle here into this current experience, we would find this, the goal of Buddhist practice is right here in this room. That's fantastic, I think. So that's the Vajra. So yes, just to reiterate, it's this connection, this unbreakable link, this unbreakable bond with reality that I find so wonderful about the Vajra. The Vajra, it continuously encourages this sense of movement back towards the heart, towards the kind of the core of experience. And the core experience is, this is why Akshobhya holds the Vajra in this way. It's because what Akshobhya is telling us is, no matter what our experience is, turn towards it. Look to the qualities, the particular taste, the emotional tone. What's the quality of any particular energy we find ourselves in? And this process of real receptive exploration slows down reactivity and habitual responsiveness. It opens us into ways of seeing really what is rising, what is arising in awareness. And ultimately it leads us to this liberation of a dualistic perception of our experience. So all that is reliant on awareness. And of course, unfortunately, we do lose awareness. So when we do lose our awareness, we lose that kind of quality of open attention, then we return to our reactive life, our habitual life, the reenacting, the reinforcing of already known responses to stimulus, to experience. So this is a very painful thing, to kind of wake up in the midst of being in full reaction to something in our experience. But this is what we do. So the Vajra, for me, the Vajra of Akshobhya, is a great source of solace, because it says that we can, and we do, continually return into awareness. How amazing that we can be completely out of it, just on autopilot, and then for nothing that we do, we return into awareness. We come back, we know what's happening in our experience. So this is the great solace, that we can access this wonder of awareness. And recalling Akshobhya, visualizing this figure of dark blue light holding the Vajra, it reveals and reminds us that we can wield the Vajra and transform our perception. So we strengthen the ability to sustain curiosity, sustain clear seeing, really explore experience without bias, without agenda. We naturally begin to release from habits. And we also begin to release from those kind of strategies that we use of inference and supposition and fabrication, all which are clouding and distorting our clear perception of arising experience. So the last thing about the Vajra, just quickly mention, is that in relation to Akshobhya, the hand of Akshobhya. So Akshobhya holds the Vajra in an open hand. So this symbol held in an open hand points to the sense for me of this of integration and acceptance of all that we are. And I say that because for myself, I really believe that we need the whole of us to engage in the spiritual life. If we try to kind of knock pieces off of ourselves to kind of fit what we think we should be as a spiritual being, then we're lost, really. We've kind of lost part of the potential energy, the resource that we need to really be fully present. So the Vajra, for me, invites us into wholeness. This is what I see the Vajra doing. It's an invitation to become whole, to integrate everything that we are. So it's said that a water container, when broken, cannot display the reflection of the moon. And we could say from that that the image of the Buddha does not show in broken, divided awareness, divided sentient beings. The Vajra really unites our brokenness, our split off parts from ourselves. It weaves the whole of our nature into a rich resource so that we have the confidence and stability to turn and really face our life as it is. And in the turning towards, everything naturally and gradually transforms into this direct knowing of non-duality, which is at the heart of Buddhist practice, at the heart of the Vajra. So that's the left hand. Now we're going to move to the right hand, to the mudra of Akshobhya, touching the earth. So the earth-touching mudra suggests something about the direct knowing that comes out of being embodied. The coming down into our bodies, touching the earth of here and now. So you might know, you might be familiar to you, the quality of sensation sometimes seems to shift quite dramatically when we feel ourselves embodied. It may be that perhaps when we're working physically, very engaged in some kind of physical activity, and then we take a break, it's as if the world around us has sharpened in some way. It's become brighter, become more vivid. And there's a sense that the world is somehow exact as it is. There's a particularity to every part of that experience. So it feels as if the world is somehow responding to the quality of simple but clear awareness. And this internal sense of an embodied spaciousness. It's as if something beyond my sense of self-absorption, self-interest, seems to call me out of that limited view into a more sort of unbounded state. It's unbounded, but it's very precise. Do we know that experience of just being in nature in some way? It's just that clarity, that crispness of the experience. So this is a really pleasurable experience, to feel really embodied in the moment. And the more can really settle into that sense of being embodied, then that experience itself can really become a support and the means to become unshakable, which is a quality of Akshobhya. To be able to bear the ever-swirling, changing experiences, both within us and without. So this is what maybe is meant when we talk about sitting like a mountain in meditation, and we'll be going back to this later. So something about this state of being with, utterly turning towards all that we are, all that is in experience, that simply state of opening to what is connected to Akshobhya. And it's connected, comes from actually a story of the kind of the earlier lives of Akshobhya. Before he became Akshobhya, this kind of archetypal Buddha figure, he was a simple monk. And he was, it's said that what he did, he made a great vow. This powerful vow, which said that he would not turn away with aversion or hatred to any experience, that he would sit with experience as it was. So this is an incredibly powerful vow, just that I am vowing to stay with experience. So this is a vow is seen in some ways as a vow of this sort of a renouncing of experience. So what we would renounce as we move towards becoming kind of more attuned with akshobhya is that we renounce inference and expectation. So we're not trying to make anything more of experience. We're not trying to create more than what is actually here. So it's renouncing fabrication. We're renouncing sticking or binding around any view, any belief, any strategy. So this is a really powerful act to really vow that whatever arises in awareness, we will not turn away from it. So the earth-touching mudra reminds us of the power of not acting out of a desire to turn away from, distort, even destroy that which appears to be unbearable to us. So this is a very powerful path of renunciation. We renounce trying to protect our own delusions. This is what we're doing, trying to continuously turn back towards experience. Really test out, continue to be curious. Is that really how it is? Do we really need to grip onto that? Because the natural tendency is that we tend to move away from experiences that don't fit our views. We turn away from experiences that perhaps are too uncomfortable because they tend to challenge us to start to break down this kind of sense of ourselves that we may have. So akshobhya is really encouraging us to just let things be as they are and just be with those experiences. And when we can really do that, the world actually begins to shake. This is what it says in the sutra when the monk that became akshobhya made this vow, the earth shook. So it's as if the world celebrates, supports us, encourages us by brightening and radiating. So as we look, we see that what we imagined or surmised or inferred as being solid or real, it actually begins to soften, even dissolve. In the quality of awareness, these illusions of solidity cannot sustain themselves. So the insubstantial nature of all phenomena begins to reveal itself. So this takes me to the last little bit that I just want to mention this evening, which is each of the figures in the Buddha Mandala are associated with an element, and the element that akshobhya is associated with is water. So as if when we explore experience directly, without agenda, it begins to flow, to transform on its own. By turning towards experience fully, we begin to see the fluidity that is inherent in the experience. So we don't have to do anything, we simply turn towards experience and it will naturally begin to become fluid. And the quality of water is that water gathers and finds its own level. So small amounts of water begin to move to create a stream, a rivulet. The river, pools, ocean. So it's as if all experience, if we sustain curiosity, will gradually be led back to the ocean or to this sense of a deep, clear and still lake. The vast expanse of water is clear and lucid and mirror-like. So this is the image of water trickling down through us. Cascades of energy coming to earth, gradually settling. So we're just not doing anything, we're just allowing the water of attention, of these being with different experience, the water will gradually settle. If we don't try to twist, distort experience, it will settle. It will find its own level. The more we allow this flow to continue, eventually it will find its natural bedrock. The clearer it will become. The stiller it will become. So this is really the heart of Akshobhya. This still, clear, dark blue, mirror-like lake. This is the imperturbability. This is the deep, dark blue stillness of Akshobhya.